Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What changes might the post-Larry Summers era bring to the American economy? What you didn't know about the foreclosure crisis, and carrots, baby carrots, they're too cool for school. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 22nd of September, the calendar says, and it is good to have you here. The White House announced yesterday that Larry Summers, the head of the National Economic Council, is going to leave by the end of the year to go back to Harvard. Coming as it does at the end of a wave of midterm resignations from key administration economic jobs, Summers' departure does make one wonder whether policy changes might be in the offing at the White House. Sarah Rosen-Wartell was the deputy director of the National Economic Council in the Clinton White House. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Do me a favor and take 30 seconds and remind us what the director of the National Economic Council actually does.
They have two principal functions. The first is that they run and oversee the deliberative process by which many different voices from throughout the administration come together to advise the president on economic policy. And then also it's one of the president's most important economic advisors themselves, along with the Treasury Secretary, the director of the OMB, and the chairman of the CEA.
In that policy coordination role, it's something of an honest broker, right?
Certainly. The sort of norm is always that you make sure there's a good opportunity for all the president's advisors to be heard and also then at the end provide your own counsel.
So given that and given the fact that Larry Summers is going back to Harvard, is it possible that this move could or might signal a change in economic policy from the White House?
I don't think it's going to be a major change. I think it's going to be a movement to the next phase of the administration's economic strategy. They really felt from the beginning that there were some key foundational elements they had to put in place: Recovery Act, healthcare, financial systems reform. And they've made crystal clear that moving forward, creating jobs in the economy is going to be job one for the president and for his entire team. And the new director will have that as their principal charge.
What else might they do then? I mean, other than jobs, there's the deficit, there's trade. I mean, there's a lot going on.
Well, in some ways, all of this relates to how do we create a globally competitive economy that allows us to keep consumption high, people employed, savings levels up, bring the business community and all other parts of the economy together to build up the kind of infrastructure, the architecture of the new economy that's going to work not only through the recession, but into this next era.
You mentioned bringing businesses along. What do you make of the talk that the president might pick somebody with a business background, a CEO perhaps, to run this thing?
There's been a lot of concern among some in the business community that they would like to see someone with more business background in the administration. I do think it would make sense for them to do that. It would be valuable if they had a progressive-minded business leader who could partner with the business community and talk to them about how they come to the table in the job creations challenge.
You were in the Clinton White House helping to run the National Economic Council there. Could you sort of compare and contrast your experience versus an experience in this White House with these challenges? Is the National Economic Council more relevant, less relevant?
The importance of the economy to the challenges this country faces right now has never been greater. It certainly didn't feel unimportant in my day. We worked extremely hard. It was, NEC really became central to organizing so much of our international and domestic policy agenda. But the pressures on the current team is like nothing that we ever experienced. And I think that we have to remember that this team has really brought us a remarkable way from where they were on the first day and under enormous, enormous pressure.
Sarah Rosen-Wartell is an executive vice president at the Center for American Progress. She's also a former deputy director of the National Economic Council under President Clinton. Sarah, thanks a lot for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How many stories have you heard about struggling homeowners whose mortgage servicers don't call back, or that lose their application for a loan modification, say? You hear them all the time, right? Okay, so here's one about a big mortgage servicer that's been too efficient with paperwork, foreclosure documents to be specific. Ally Financial, an underwriter of this broadcast, has stopped foreclosures and evictions in 23 states after it discovered that employees had approved some foreclosure documents without reading them, without making sure that the information that led to the foreclosure in the first place was right. At Ally, one guy signed off on 10,000 cases in a single month. The bank says it was just a technical defect. There was no fraud involved. But our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has this look at the broader implications.
It wasn't supposed to work this way. When mortgages started being sliced up, packaged, and sold to many different investors, a wave of foreclosures wasn't part of the equation. Neither, it seems, was keeping track of where so many original deeds ended up. Iowa Assistant Attorney General Patrick Madigan heads a National Foreclosure Prevention Task Force.
Just the sheer number of foreclosures, the sheer amount of paperwork has overwhelmed the system. I think that's undeniable.
What that representative of mortgage servicer Ally now admits is that he didn't really personally verify the paperwork in each case. And banking consultant Bert Ely says that problem is almost certainly shared by other big mortgage servicers.
Are they able to proceed with these foreclosures where they don't have all the paperwork and have not been able to properly dot all the I's and cross all the T's?
Ely says attorneys for homeowners are pressing this paperwork issue in a growing number of cases, but it's unclear how many other loan servicers might have skipped legal steps. At the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, real estate finance professor Susan Wachter says without that paperwork, any foreclosure can't proceed.
That's the beginning and the end. One has to document that one has ownership before one can take possession.
And from the perspective of struggling homeowners, she says, if more banks put foreclosures on hold, it buys precious time to wait out the market until they can sell.
If housing prices do bottom, as we certainly hope they will, obviously this is giving more breathing time.
Wachter puts it this way, facing possible foreclosure is always better than facing certain foreclosure. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Much has been written lately about the costs of obesity. It's in the billions of dollars to society at large. Now, though, for the first time, researchers have pinpointed obesity's effect on an individual's pocketbook. From North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin has more.
The study got really specific about the cost of being obese. $4,879 a year if you're a woman, and $2,646 a year if you're a man. George Washington University professor Christine Ferguson co-authored the study. She says obese people have higher medical expenses, including hospitalization and doctor visits, and they also pay the price at work.
Like lost wages that you don't earn because of your obesity, the cost of disability, sick leave, and the cost of productivity.
Some of those costs are shared by employers. But why the disparity between men and women?
A significant portion of that difference is due to the wages that women who are obese don't earn because of what I would say is a stigma against obese women.
While gender discrimination is illegal, only one state, Michigan, bars discrimination against large-size workers. Joe Nadglowski is president of the nonprofit Obesity Action Coalition.
In this country currently, if a company wants to pay their obese employees less money, there's nothing that prevents them from doing so. It is not illegal.
The upside of the study? Weight loss can pay off. In some cases, reducing your weight by just 5 to 7% can lead to better health as well as a fatter wallet. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nuh-uh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to be pretty interesting if the president does pick a business type to replace Larry Summers, because at some point, private spending, that is, private corporate spending, is going to have to replace all the government money that's supporting the economy right now. Commentator Robert Reich says that what happens in Washington over the next couple of years is going to depend on what kind of businesses get the most political clout.
Some giant American corporations depend on a buoyant American economy and a world-class industrial base in the United States. That's because their business strategy is built around U.S. consumers. A second group of companies are gleaning substantial profits from their overseas operations, especially China, India, and Brazil. Now, not surprisingly, this second group is doing far better than the first, because American consumers are reluctant to spend, while China, India, and Brazil are spending like mad. What does this mean for politics? In my experience, big companies most dependent on American consumers are also most supportive of expansive fiscal and monetary policies. These policies cause unemployment to drop and wages to grow, and thereby get Americans consuming again. Companies in this first group are also less obsessed by inflation and deficits, and they're more likely to support new investments in infrastructure and education, which improve the productivity and earnings of Americans over the longer term. Yet more and more American companies are moving into the second group that get their profits overseas, because that's where the money and the markets are. Years ago, the Business Roundtable consisted mostly of big American corporations that were indubitably American and took largely progressive positions on U.S. jobs and wages. I recall working with the National Association of Manufacturers to improve U.S. education and job training, which was one of their major goals. The American Electronics Association pushed the Reagan administration for an industrial policy to preserve and enlarge the industrial base of U.S. computing. But now that big American corporations are going global as fast as they can, we're losing companies that champion the American economy and American workers. This may be good for their shareholders, but in a Washington ever more susceptible to corporate money and influence, the trend is not necessarily good for most Americans.
Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His new book is called Aftershock: The Next Economy and America's Future. David Frum is going to be here next week at this spot in the broadcast. Your thoughts are welcome anytime at all. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Getting kids to eat their veggies is a challenge even when they're little and you can keep an eye on them at home. Once they get older, into high school, say, and they can pick and choose what they eat, forget it. That's why the news out of Mason, Ohio caught our eye this morning. There's a new vending machine in the local high school. It's great, except that it sells only baby carrots, 50 cents a bag, and apparently they're selling like hotcakes, really healthy hotcakes. We've got Tracy Carson on the line from the Mason School District. Tracy, good to have you here.
Nice to be here, Kai.
How did it come to pass that the Mason schools have carrots in their vending machines?
Well, you know, our families, like a lot of families, are concerned about what their kids are eating. And so we were very excited to be approached by a bunch of carrot farmers, which is how Bolt House Farms is being known, their ad agency that was working with them. We thought, this is great, a real win-win.
Those ads are pretty cool, actually. I mean, they're up on the website, and they're you got heavy metal.
Baby carrots! Baby carrots!
There's something for everyone, for sure.
Now, let me ask you this. Are the kids buying them?
You know what? They are. They've only been in for a couple of days, but we looked, and they're kind of flying off the shelf. Baby carrots have been in our cafeterias for a while, but somehow when you get to go to the vending machine, it just makes it a little more cool.
And it's probably worth pointing out that the other vending machines don't work during school hours, right? No sodas, no...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So the market monopoly kind of helps them out.
Exactly.
Now, you have an entrepreneurial class in your high school where these kids worked on the marketing campaign?
We do. We've had for probably almost 7 years now an Entrepreneurs in Action class. And so when we got wind of this, we thought we have got to get, you know, the only way we will we'll do this is if our students get to have this great educational experience along with it. So that class has divided in teams, and for the next 6 weeks, they're coming up with their own marketing plans for baby carrots, and whichever team sells the most will be the big winner. But even the bigger winner is they're going to donate all of the profits to charity, and they're looking into a couple of eyesight charities. Of course, carrots having a little bit
of
connection with vision.
Of course.
So.
What about parents? I mean, they've got to be thrilled, right?
You know, absolutely. Our families are having that same conversation that families across the country are having. And, you know, as a mom myself, it's something that I want is for my child to choose healthy options. And it sure makes it easier when those options seem a little more tantalizing.
Are your kids in high school? Do they actually have the opportunity to buy these carrots?
I do have a freshman in high school,
and
he came home yesterday and asked me, Mom, did you know we have carrots in a vending machine in the high school? And I said, absolutely, and he thought that was pretty neat. Of course, he never has cash on him. He's only freshman, so he needs to ask Mom for 50 cents.
Now, I'm going to tell on you a little bit here. You were talking to my producer before we got on the phone. You did not eat healthy today.
I did not. I have to admit that a carrot vending machine at my office might be a good thing as well.
Tracy Carson, she's the public information officer at Mason School District in Mason, Ohio. Tracy, thanks a lot.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Coming up, which came first, the oil drilling or the subsidy?
Does the tax credit lead to more drilling than we'd see otherwise? And I think the answer is, yes, it does.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 21 points today. That's about 0.2%, ended things at 10,739. The NASDAQ off 14 points, 0.2%, closed at 2334. The S&P 500 lost 5 points, 0.5%, finished at 1134. Investors continue to worry about what the Federal Reserve's message from yesterday really meant. Morgan Stanley lost 4% today. Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs each gave back 2%. JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup each rang up losses of more than 1.5%. Microsoft deleted more than 2% today despite bumping up its quarterly dividend. One reason why? Microsoft just borrowed $6 billion in part to make that dividend payment. General Mills scooped up 2.75% after beating earnings projections today. Netflix posted a 6.5% gain after Blockbuster Video gets set to file for bankruptcy. That's supposed to come tomorrow. We've been waiting for it for a while now. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for August. And extreme weather is the focus at a briefing held by the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. The floods in Pakistan are on the agenda. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
It's the rare media company that can afford to give up advertising revenue in this day and age, but that is what's being asked of the Village Voice. Attorneys general from 21 states have asked the Voice's Backpage.com to drop its adult services section. A couple of weeks ago, Craigslist closed its adult section, but the government's not getting the same kind of cooperation this time, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal wants Backpage.com to discontinue classified ads for adult services.
The adult services sections are little more than online brothels in many instances.
His office estimates that Village Voice Media, which owns Backpage.com, makes more than $17 million a year from adult services ads.
They are big money makers for these sites, and we're asking the sites to put people before profits.
Unlike Craigslist, Backpage.com says it won't stop the ads. In a written response, the company says it's operating legally and assists law enforcement with prosecutions. Ryan Kahlo is with the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School.
It's pretty clear that the courts have spoken on this issue, and there's no legal recourse. A website like Backpage.com will not be held responsible for what users do on the website.
Kahlo says ending the adult services ads might backfire.
It may be harder to police to the extent that it's harder for law enforcement to set up traps. It's harder for the websites themselves to monitor for illegal content. It may make the situation worse.
But critics of the ads point out that they're frequently used in trafficking children for sexual purposes. Linda Smith is president of the rescue organization Shared Hope International. It did a 4-year investigation of the trafficking of children.
Practically every minor that we dealt with was marketed repeatedly city by city. It has become the marketplace for these children.
There are no hard numbers for the child sex industry, but Smith estimates it's in the billions. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Even though Senate Democrats decided a couple of months ago they don't have the votes to pass a comprehensive energy bill this year, Energy Committee Chairman Jeff Bingaman is still fighting the good fight. He introduced a bill yesterday that would force energy companies to generate a certain minimum percentage of green power. Where it gets sticky, though, is in this evaluation of the bill's chances from one energy analyst. And this is a quote, "We give near zero odds," they said, "for passage of this bill in 2010. So for now, at least, official government policy on energy is the same it's been for decades. We are a fossil fuel economy, and that's what we're going to support with tax breaks and subsidies that have been in place for a very long time." From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has more.
The world's petroleum economy goes back more than a century. So do petroleum subsidies. That's the sound of light sweet crude pumped from the oldest operating oil well in the world. No, this is not Saudi Arabia. It's Titusville, Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh. Here, in 1859, a train conductor named Edwin Drake drilled a big hole in search of oil, a potentially new cheap source of fuel for lamps.
At that point in time, people kind of thought he was a little nuts.
Local historian Dan Weaver.
Their well came in on August 27th, 1859, at a depth of about 69.5 feet. It was from that moment that the industry was truly born.
The song American Petroleum Polka played as drillers rushed in and rig workers and barrel makers. First, the oil was refined into kerosene, and a generation later into gasoline when the internal combustion engine and the automobile hit the scene. But drilling was costly. So to help the fledgling energy sector, state governments gave companies a generous tax break for buying supplies and building access roads. Without the deduction, the industry may not have taken off, says consultant Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners.
It was really about the economics of doing it at all. It was whether or not the business existed.
The state deduction became a federal one in 1913, the same year the federal income tax was ratified, and the write-off has aged well. It's beat back several challenges, and today, federal fossil fuel subsidies in all run about $10 billion a year, more than double those for renewable energy. And Tufts University economist Gilbert Metcalf says it's time to end them.
100 years later, I think that it's time for these industries to leave the nest and stand on their own 2 feet. Congress never has the right exit strategy to figure out how to phase things out.
Subsidy backers say it's the worst time for a phase-out because another hydrocarbon boom is afoot, once again in western Pennsylvania. This drill rig is going a mile down for vast quantities of natural gas encased in rock. Energy companies consider this a game-changer. Pittsburgh native Jeff Ventura is the CEO of drilling company Range Resources.
The biggest discovery I've ever been associated with is right back in my hometown and almost literally right beneath the house that my mom still lives in today.
To drill here in what's called the Marcellus Shale, Range builds new roads to accommodate its heavy trucks. The costs are all deductible, helping the company cut its federal tax bill to almost zero, according to Businessweek. In other words, Range takes more than a third of its income and plows it into gas production instead of paying Uncle Sam.
And with that, we've discovered fields like the Marcellus now that could be 500 trillion cubic feet of gas, second largest gas field in the world.
An oil industry study says a firm like this would still eke out a profit without key subsidies. But at this diner in hard-hit western Pennsylvania, the point is jobs. The gas boom is creating an estimated 100,000 of them. Gravel supplier Barry Fink helps drilling firms pave access roads.
We need investment here to keep the jobs here, and the only way you're going to encourage, whether it's a small business, an entrepreneur, or a larger company to do that, is through certain select tax breaks.
At the same time, nonpartisan experts say the tax breaks are speeding up the depletion of energy resources and are propping up smaller companies that otherwise would not be in business. Again, Tufts economist Gilbert Metcalf.
Does the tax credit lead to more drilling than we'd see otherwise? And I think the answer is, yes, it does.
This fall, many federal lawmakers want to cancel historic drilling subsidies in favor of tax breaks for renewable energy. If that happens, the question is, will it take another century to ask if those tax breaks have outlived their usefulness? In western Pennsylvania, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. By CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, another auto recall to tell you about. Does seem like they just keep coming, doesn't it? It's a potential hazard to pedestrians this time. Bentley is recalling 1,400 cars worldwide. Seems the hood ornaments are faulty. The big silver letter Bs with wings on them are supposed to retract automatically if a pedestrian bumps into them. They are pretty big, so you could see how they'd hurt if you hit them. Average price tag for a Bentley, by the way, somewhere north of $300,000. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but you figure for that kind of cash, they get it right the first time. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 21 points. That's 0.2%. The NASDAQ gave back 14 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 lost 5 points, about 0.5%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program.
The shadow market isn't really a physical place like Wall Street or the New York Stock Exchange. It's more of an invisible nexus.
But when things happen there, oh yeah, you feel it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.